overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change. You create a brand new life.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center for Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week.
So good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this Sunday morning. I'm in a room with a lot of lovely people wearing masks, and I want to thank them for coming out. And for all of you at home in virtual world, I want to welcome you for this brief time together to merge in that field of love, the love that we all share. It's the one love, the one life. And the only thing that it asks is that we say yes to that life, that we come home to the truth of our being. Last week I spoke about the road home. And in that talk, I realized that there is no journey home because you're already home. As the sign says above my head, I have arrived, I am home. And so the irony is we're already at the very place that we seek to be seeking. And knowing that, the seeking stops. And we can rest in that place of home. I love the word rest. Last week I made an acronym out of rest, and I'm going to reflect on that. The R was to relax, recognize, remember that you have returned. The E is to embrace everything that we experience with an equanimity. That means that everything is here for us. Equanimity doesn't push something away or grab onto something. It says everything that I am experiencing is truly here for me because I am home in that heart space, in the context of my being. The S was to savor and surrender to the sacredness of life. Surrender. Savor this sacred moment. And then the T would be to taste and touch and treasure the truth that unhides itself from within. And then the last T is to trust in that, to trust in the truth of our being. And so as we align ourselves to this dynamic of resting in what is, we then can open our hearts and open our minds and invite those who are just walking in the room to find a place to sit, knowing that spirit is always on time. And I'm going to invite you to merge the head and the heart. Whether your heart reaches up to the head or the head comes down into the heart, it doesn't matter. But what is significant is that we're not separating them anymore. In oneness, it doesn't seem logical that we would want to separate the head and the heart and make one right and the other wrong. But in unity consciousness, we can place them together in an intimate relationship, not unlike an octopus or a human, saying, how could those two species possibly resonate? And yet if you've seen The Octopus Teacher, you know that it's simpatico, it's beyond understanding with the local mind. but the heart mind can tune into it. They connected in a field of love that was greater than human love or animal love. And then we get to stretch our perception out of the local identification with our local mind that by its very nature has opinions and judgments and a history and a herstory, but in the no mind, in the infinite mind, we can actually tap into the mind of an octopus because we're not separate. And so the invitation this Sunday is to expand that field of our perception beyond the local mind into the spaciousness of an infinite mind that contains thought, but it contains so much more than thought. And so I invite you to move behind thought into that field of awareness, an awareness out of which all thought arises, but awareness that is not bound by our thoughts and opinions and judgments. And we sense a freedom because we've come home to this awareness of being. Last Sunday, I concluded with a beautiful letter to the divine from a young man named Jeff Foster, who merged with the I am. I am man, I am woman, I am inside, I am outside. I am thought, and I am no thought. I am love, and I am also sadness. This I am is everything. And the I tends to make it personal, but when we let go of the I and we just rest as am, then we are the beingness itself, seemingly localized in human form, but truly an amness that is universal. And we get to rest as that. When Moses asked God, "What shall I call you?" it is reputed that God said, "I am." What is my name? I am that I am. And so when we know that we are made in the image and likeness of that I am, we can be that. Notice how time stands still and we move into a timelessness. In fact, time is a construct of the mind, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. But in the soul, we live in a timeless, eternal now. And so the invitation is then to stretch out of an identification with this egoic me into this eternal we. Where time dissolves, and yet time does exist. So in this eternal now, the past can inform the present. In this eternal now, the future can inform the present. And we rest at that central point of the breath. Which takes me into my exploration this Sunday morning of breathing in and breathing out. I invite you to put your attention on the breath. That breath that when we took that first breath, we entered into this life form. And when we leave this life form, we will have our last exhalation. And so what if life rests on the breath? And then we look deeper into this sacred breath of life and we realize that the breath is breathing us. There is very little control or effort in breathing, unless of course we make it effortful and we seek to control the breath. But if we practice that surrendering, then we can notice that the breath is flowing in and flowing out. Anchor yourself in the breath. It's that still point. I hear Karen Drucker's beautiful song, "I breathe in I breathe out. I take in. I give out. I let love. I let go. I release. I know. And then she says, breathe, breathe, breathe. And so we rest in that breath that is breathing us. She says, I forgive and I forget. I trust and I know that in this breath I am free of all the struggle, of all the goal setting, of all the regrets. In this simple breath, I am truly polishing the mirror of the heart. As I witness this breath, I am polishing the mirror of my mind. And so as that other song says, I can see clearly now. The pain is gone. I can see all the obstacles that were in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's going to be a bright, bright, sunshiny day. And so as we let go of the clouded thoughts of yesterday, perhaps the clouded thoughts of today and tomorrow, then that light of truth, that light of awareness shines through, and we see clearly, not from a mind that is cluttered with concerns and beliefs and opinions and judgments, but with a mind that is free, that reflects back the beauty that's all around us and within us, a heart that is pure. And we hear the beatitude, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And so as we do this gentle business of cleaning the mirror of the heart and the mind, we can see clearly and we can love freely, not bound by yesterday's concerns, but truly filled with possibility and hope that life will once again reveal its mystery and its beauty that's always there. And by means of this opening prayer, it's unhiding itself. It's showing itself to us yet again. As you prepare to enter into this dialogue this Sunday, I invite you to put your hands over your heart and make that connection to the sacred heart that's within you. What they call in Buddhism the bodhicitta, the heart-mind. And when you're ready to experience the intimacy of belonging to one another today, you can open your eyes and open your hands, and you can wiggle your tentacles like little octopus. Here you go. I'm so glad that some of you have turned on Netflix and watched the documentary, My Octopus Teacher. It's funny that something so humble as that documentary can have such an impact on the heart, for me anyway, because as I was watching that documentary, it was hard for me to watch the shark going after the little octopus, but yet it was so resilient that it had the strength to find its way home. It had the courage to reach out to another species that was interested. It had the courage to become intimate with a human being. And you know, it's not easy to become intimate with human beings, because human beings, by their very nature, I think, lack deep commitment. But this fellow, whoever he was, showed up every morning without an oxygen tank, without a wetsuit, in the ice-cold waters. And even when he couldn't breathe and his breath was fainting, he didn't want to leave the tentacle that was embracing his finger, because there was such intimacy there. So the more that this beautiful documentary, you know, he had that relationship for over 300 days. And it's so funny, my partner, he loves to do research. Every time we're watching the TV, he's on his computer, and he wanted to find the longevity of octopus. I said, oh, put the computer down. No, octopuses live just 6 months. And I'm thinking, oh God, well, that octopus isn't going to be around long. And then when he's over 300 days, I say, this little octopus didn't follow the rules. She lived here longer than she was supposed to. And so what if we and the humans, we want to understand the ego wants to control, wants to fix, wants to, but the soul just kind of surrenders into the mystery and allows it to unfold. And so this is kind of the place that I like to play in that mind that can stretch itself so that it doesn't feel limited by the local mind. Someone asked about context here and content. And I'm helping Lisa Ferraro with her Soul Call ministry. She's launching this new ministry in Columbus, Ohio. And she's asked people to come and mentor her. And several are there, and they have shared with Lisa on the Zoom call that we're here to help bring you content, Lisa, for your Soul Call ministries. And I said, well, I'm not here to bring you any content at all. I'm here to bring you the context. The context is the spaciousness. It's the field where we meet. And then in that field, could we let what's in that field arise? When I use that beautiful acronym of resting in home, could we rest in an awareness that's beyond thought? Could we rest in a love that's beyond attachment? Could we rest in a peace that the Bible says passes all understanding? You know, you can find deep peace. My sister-in-law made her transition on Thursday morning, and it was very strange because her spirit came to Trey, at least he thinks she did, on Wednesday morning. He went down into the dining room. It was about 6 in the morning, and he heard a sound. It was like whistling or chimes, and he heard this breeze blowing. And because she was on hospice, he thought, oh, Susan must have passed. But she didn't pass till 24 hours later. And so he said, well, what was that, David? I said, I think the spirit is able to leave the body and to visit you. And then last night, we were having dinner, and in the middle of dinner, one of the paintings fell off the wall, like a poltergeist type thing. And it was the painting that his mother had given us years and years ago, the mother that Trey and Susan shared. And the frame didn't break. And Trey said, what was that? And I said, I think that was Susan, just letting you know that she's okay. And he says, couldn't she come to me as a butterfly or a hummingbird? I said, honey, you can't tell the universe how it's supposed to come. So what if we could open to the mystery of life? And the greatest mystery of life itself is to know that this life was never born and never dies. I did a memorial service yesterday at Laughlin's for a man that I'd never met, but who had been here once and who was impressed by my whatever, and his wife and daughter came to see me. And I said, well, if you want me to do this, I'm honored to do it, but I just want you to know that I'm going to probably say that he didn't die, that he's still here with you. Because I believe that with all my heart, that what we are doesn't die. The body dies, yes, but the spirit is eternal. And when you've been as alive as long as I have, and you have so many that are with you, I feel my mother all the time. I feel my father in his crazy sort of way. And I believe that we transmit one another to each other, just like the octopus and that human. I think she'll be with him. And I have this little dog who made her transition about a year ago, baby Speck, and I feel haunted by her presence. You know, my dog Bert, when she died, they were like this. And after she made her transition, everything about her seemed to transfer to him. He never chased a ball, not once in his life. He's 15 years old now. She makes her transition, she was obsessed with the ball. All of a sudden, we're walking around a baseball field, and Bert finds an old baseball. And he picks it up and he starts throwing it in the air. And Trey and I looked at each other, what the hell's going on? Bert's throwing the ball in the air. And we both said, baby Speck used to do that. And baby Speck, if you didn't throw the ball, she would take her nose and she'd push the ball right at you. I'm telling you to throw that ball. And what do you think Bert did? He put his nose down to the baseball and he shoved it right to Trey's feet. And I said, okay, here she is. I know, I think I'm crazy. You're probably gonna think I'm crazy. And so we threw the ball and Bert chased it as if baby Speck had stepped into his body. She let him use it. The other thing that happened was baby Speck was terrified of thunderstorms. Every time we have one in Huntsville, she cowers and goes into the bathroom and hides under the sink. Bert could care less about thunderstorms. All of a sudden, the thunderstorms start to come. And where do you think Bert is? He's in the bathroom under the sink, shaking like a leaf. So I take baby Speck's old thunder shirt out. And he comes waddling over, his tail between his legs, shaking like a leaf. And I wrap that thunder shirt around him just like I wrapped it around the baby. And he's at peace. So could we open to the mystery of this something greater by just the willingness to let go of the mind that thinks it knows everything and enter into the curiosity of the soul. You know, the ego wants to have answers. The ego wants to be in control. And even though we go into somebody training as a young child, Ram Dass says, we come here as a nobody, and then we go into somebody training. And he says, and then when maybe you've had a heart attack, you begin to wake up to something that is so much greater. Maybe it's your soul begins to wake up. And then he says, you go back into nobody training. So Nisargadatta says, when you know you're nobody, that's when wisdom starts to flower. And when you know that you're everybody and everything, I would add, that's when love begins to flower. So I'm nothing and I'm everything? Yeah. You're nothing and you're everything. That means then that you have this egoic mind that you've cultivated over a lifetime with goals and ambitions. And hopefully if you're crazy like me, you have all these damn degrees that qualify you for nothing. And yet you have this hungry soul that aches for truth that was there when you were a little kid and is still there. And the soul that doesn't want to have answers, but the soul that wants to find meaning. Wants to find meaning in everything. And so when you lie on the floor and someone's saying to love your body and then you feel this love coming up that you had never felt before, that's when the mystery begins to unveil itself. A young lady showed up here I haven't seen in a long time, and apparently she had a car accident that could have killed her. But what it did was it awoke her to a deep healing of her own inner child. So what if we could say yes to the mystery of this healing? It's so much greater. When we get out of the way, something can happen. I'm doing a series this month based on a little book that I read when I was on vacation called Polishing the Mirror of the Heart, which is a Sufi idea. And you know, it's also a Christian idea. Richard Rohr speaks about polishing the mirror of the heart. This is a little book that I've taught here at the center. And he talks called Wiping the Mirror. This is his take on cleaning the mirror of the heart. He said, the Zen Buddhist masters tell us that we need to wipe the mirror of our minds and the mirror of our hearts in order to see what's there without our distortions or even our explanations. You know, we taught a class here in my ministerial class. It was called The Work by Byron Katie. And she said, we form conclusions in life. And then we'll say things like, oh, life is really hard. Or so-and-so is a jerk. And those are just thoughts. And so in The Work, the way she polishes the mirror of the heart, you can have a real strong conviction in your mind. And then the first question, is that true? Yes, of course it's true. Life that is hard and it sucks. And then the second question, is it really true? Well, no, parts of it are kind of nice and sweet. And when my dog gets on my lap or puts her my head there, when my cat purrs on my belly, I guess life isn't so bad or hard. So in other words, what you've been telling yourself isn't totally true. And then Byron Katie, the third question is, how would you be if you didn't think that restrictive, judgmental thought? Well, I'd probably be free. And then the fourth question is, could you be willing to let go of that narrative? Huh? Have you noticed when you let go of your grievance and your story and you're arguing for the limited idea? One of the very first ideas I had as a brand new young minister came from Marcus Bach, who said, if you argue for the limited idea, it's yours. Huh? What? If you argue for the limited idea, it's yours. I had a young lady, a friend of mine in Atlanta, and she had a bad relationship. So then she wanted to make a generalized statement that all men are jerks. 101, all men are jerks. I said, but I'm a man, am I a jerk? Oh, you're not a real man. All men are jerks, but you're not a real man. Okay. Imagine how she would think if she didn't hold that thought in her head. She'd be free of that limited idea that just constricted her. So I use that as just a little metaphor for us to examine and get clear on what thought pattern needs to be expunged from your belief system and what emotion needs to be purged by a willingness to meet that wounded child like Norma Jean did. She's having a huge healing, you know, and she's in her senior years of life, and to think that she would meet her own little girl at this stage of life is really quite sacred. It took a heart attack for me to meet my own abandoned little boy, who had been shamed, who had been told that he wasn't acceptable, that he wasn't enough. And when his not enoughness would come up, I wasn't to shame that not enoughness out of him. I was to say, no, you are enough. And when he was sad, I wasn't to say, no, don't be sad as a little boy. I said, okay, you go ahead and be sad, and you'll be my little octopus, and I'll put my arms around you, and I'll kiss you, and I'll love you. And so all of him got to be present. And so much of what life is to integrate all the abandoned parts of ourself. Not to, in the old way of thinking, get rid of the negative parts and only affirm the positive, but to embrace the all of us. When we can embrace the all of our own selves, then we can embrace the all of the planet. We can embrace our mother, who may have unskillful ways, and our father. And then we find that forgiveness starts to flower. And we begin to even thank them. In our class, Healers on Healing, this week, they talked about healing relationships. And they said, sometimes a healing relationship doesn't look the way you think it should look. You know, what we think normally, what the ego thinks of a healing relationship, is someone who can fix me, someone who supports me, someone who uplifts me. But what if the healing relationships that are the most transformational are the ones that wound you? You know, and then I thought of the two abusive relationships I had in my life. And in a strange sort of way, I could say that they healed me from my dependency on them to my actual autonomy as me. Susan knows what I'm talking about. When I healed and left those dysfunctional relationships that I thought were abusive, set me free to loving myself in a much greater way than I ever could have loved myself. So they were healing relationships too. So back to polishing the mirror with Richard Rohr. He says mirror wiping, I love it, he calls it mirror wiping, is the inner discipline of calmly observing our own patterns, what we see and what we don't see, in order to get our demanding and over-defended egos away from the full control that they always want. The ego wants to be in control. It wants to have answers. It wants to fix everybody. It wants to tell people what they're doing wrong. So we need to notice when that arises within us, he says. It requires us to stand at a distance from ourselves and listen and look with a calm, non-judgmental objectivity. Last week I shared with you Ram Dass's take on the witness self. He says the witness part of ourselves is the factor that can turn us away from being embroiled in our thoughts and emotions to, first of all, just witnessing. There's a judgmental thought. There's a critical thought. There's a disturbing emotion. There's anxiety arising. I love the word anxiety. When I studied with, what's her name? Louise Hay. She said, anxiety comes from the root running anxiety. And the beautiful thing about anxiety, it runs right through. Every time I think of anxiety, I think of it running right through my life. There's some anxiousness in our country. Anybody feel the anxiousness? I certainly do. Could we see it run through? And not all of our day can be anxious. I can find hope. Jean and I live in this place called hope. It's not just a place in Arkansas. It's a place in our heart. So could we discover that by willingness to let the anxiety move through when it wants to? It requires us to stand at that distance and observe it. Otherwise, we do not have these thoughts and we do not have these feelings, but rather the thoughts and the feelings have us. We're a victim of our thought patterns. We're a victim of the emotions and the anxiety and the depression until we say, ah, there you are, my little depression. There you are, my little sadness. And we begin to love them, just like we love our hips, just like we love our, you know, our flaws. There's a beautiful line from the Bible that says, could my perfect love my own imperfect? Could we love the flaws? If you've ever been married, and I've been married for 45 years, could you love them not because of the perfection that they have, but of the flaws that they exude, and to be there for those flaws? I have a husband that lives in worry, and he was given worry by his mother, who thought if you love someone, you worry about them. And so when he worries about me, I just let him know that I'm okay, and thank you for your worry, but you need not worry. You know, if I would stay a little longer after class and be talking to someone in the parking lot and didn't get home at the right time, he'd be sitting on the steps worried that something had happened, that I'd been in a car accident. I said, honey, I stayed around to talk to Gigi. I'm fine. But see how... So you love the all of the other person. There's a word called shempa in Buddhism. And shempa is so simple. It's that which hooks you, that which gets you to react, that which gets you stuck. And when you can discover where the shempas are. Adam has a tattoo on his arm and he has the control buttons on a device and he has them put in a bottle. In other words, he doesn't want the control to control his soul. And then he's got these other buttons, pause and fast forward, and I don't know what the other buttons are, but the buttons that would set you free. So he's done the work on himself to say, I don't want to be in control place. I don't want to be stuck in somebody's idea, but I want to be free. So could we do the work on ourselves long enough to be a part of the healing instead of part of the problem? I'm going to give you a titch more of Ram Dass in his book, Polishing the Mirror of the Heart, because it's truly a gem. And I'm kind of honoring him this month since he recently made his transition, and there's a little chapter in here called Breathing In and Breathing Out, which is the title of today's talk. And so I used that months ago when I put the talk titles down. And so here's how Ram Dass expresses this. He talks about Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley wrote the book called The Perennial Philosophy, one of the greatest philosophers of all time. Aldous Huxley reminds us, here's his quote, "The body exists in time." I would say the mind as well. "The spirit always exists in timelessness." It's in that eternal place. "And," he says, "the psyche, or the soul, is an amphibious creature compelled by the laws of man's being to associate itself to some extent with its body." You know, we used to think we're a body with a soul. The greater awareness is that we're a soul, an eternal soul, that has a temporary thing called a body. So he says it's this amphibious creature that's compelled by the laws of its own nature to exist to some extent in the body, but it's also capable, if it so desires, the soul, of experiencing and being identified with the spirit. So he's taking us, Ram Dass, into this realization that what we are is a soul. And the soul that has a body, the soul that also exists within spirit, a soul that is eternal, and the invitation is to know ourselves as that eternal soul, the soul that was never born and never dies, and yet it comes into form for a period of time, and we have the capacity, with a mind and a body, to know this invisible part of ourselves. We're taking journeys in our satsangs on Wednesday night in Gloryji. I love how she does it in her rattle and drum, and she'll invite us to step out of the form into the formlessness. And you know who does that? The soul. The soul can take those journeys. The ego says, "What? This is a bunch of hooey. I can't do this." But once you get into the soul, it says, "Hey, bring it on. Let me experience the invisible part of me. And then let me come back into this visible part of me. And then inquire with an open mind what just happened there." And what happens is that we begin to expand into something so much greater. That's that everything that we all share. So here's Ram Dass's take on it. He says, your whole life becomes a meditation then. It's not just sitting on a meditation pillow, which we call a zafu. He says, then all of life becomes one big zafu, no matter whether you're driving in the car, whether you're making love, or whatever you're doing. It's all meditation, and it's the practice of being here now and of simply breathing in and breathing out. Be here now. That was his first book. And notice what's breathing, which is that thing that I shared with you in the opening meditation. He says that when you meditate, and all of life is a meditation, he's saying, you begin to develop the power of your mind through concentration and through one-pointed awareness. He says, by following the breath, a simple act like following the breath, to breathe in and breathe out. There was a lady that came here for years. Her name was Cindy Swearingen. She was one of my ministerial students. And she was a yoga teacher. And there was a woman in her yoga class, and they kind of looked to the yoga teacher as the guru, because she would invite them into the witness self and to embracing and this breath. And so this woman's husband had been arrested. He was going to jail, and she was filled with anxiety and fear and all the emotions that would accompany that judgment. And so she went to Cindy, and she said, "What can I do? What can I do? Everybody knows. What can I do? What can I do?" And Cindy said one simple thing to her. She said, "Breathe." She said, "What?" She said, "Just breathe. That's all you need to do. In the courtroom, and they're sentencing him, breathe. When he goes to jail, breathe. When you're going through your anxiety, breathe." Well, Cindy said to me, years later, she ran into this woman in Scottsboro at a yard sale. And the woman came over to her and she said, Cindy, I have to tell you that what you told me was the best advice I've ever gotten. Because when all this anxiety and everything was going down, I just breathed. And I was able to get through that." He's saying the same thing. When you meditate, you begin to develop the power of your mind through concentration, through one-pointed awareness, by following the breath, or by repeating a simple mantra. Now, Ram Dass's mantra was Ram, 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 Ram. A little mantra that I love to use is be still and know that I am God. Or another mantra would just breathe, right? So just to get that single-pointed awareness. And he says, you develop the capacity to put your mind on one thought and to keep it there and to let everything else flow by. So here's a mantra, all is well. And if you don't think it is, say all is well all the time. Not just when things work out the way I want to. All is well. Single-pointed awareness. Yeah, but there's an asshole in the White House. Yeah, but all is well, right? You just get yourself out of those other thoughts. And you let them flow out, and you stay with your mantra. And you bring one thought constantly to the surface. And you keep coming back to that one thought. And you're breathing in, and you're breathing out. When I studied with Thich Nhat Hanh, and he taught us meditation, his simple technique for meditation was breathing in, I breathe in. Breathing out, I breathe out. And then he says, in, out. That's enough. Just by centering your mind on the breath, by that very simple act, we get out of the nattering nabobs of negativity and the emotional storms that might be brewing, and we return to the eye of the storm, and we find that peace that's waiting for us. We've come home. We've come home. He goes on to say, but you bring one thought constantly to the surface, and you keep coming back to this one thought, breathing in and breathing out, or simply rising, falling, or you use the mantra that I use, Ram, 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 Ram. Whether you're eating, whether you're sleeping, whether you're making love, you say Ram, 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 and it keeps going. And you spiritualize your life. You convert it all by maintaining a frame of reference that has the dual capacity of centering you and increasing the power of your one-pointed awareness. As Maharaji would tell me, he says, when you bring your mind to this one still point, then simply wait for grace. Bring your mind to that one still point, to be still and know that everything is God, and then wait for grace. Grace is the unmerited givingness of the universe. Oftentimes the grace is just the exhalation. You know, when someone's grieving or they're in an emotional upheaval, and they'll be through the receiving line and they'll come to me, and usually they fall apart in my arms. We can't do that anymore with COVID, but I notice almost without fail, I tell them to exhale. Because with the emotions, I just say exhale. And one simple exhale, whatever it was that was constricting in them, just begins to fall away. Could we take refuge in the breath? And this is the simple, profound, sweet message that Ram Dass is giving us in this book, to take refuge in the breath. Rumi says this. He says, I will set you on my breath, so you will become my life. Now, as I read that quote, I read it twice. I will set you, with a big Y, I will set you on my breath, so you will become my life. So what would be the you? Would it be divine love? I will set divine love on my breath, the breath that is always breathing. It never leaves us or forsakes us. So you will become my life. I will set the wounded child who is the wonder child on my breath. So you will become my life. I will set you, the mystery of belonging to the universe, on my breath. So you will become my life. I will set you, that beautiful little octopus, and your soul on my breath, so you will become my life. See, we're not limited to this one life. We're only limited to the one life of the universe. Holy cow. Is it that vast? Yes. And yet it is particular. So, you know, metaphor speaks volumes. When you know you're the ocean of love, you realize that this ocean of love refuses no waves. So there's the wave of depression. Come on in. You're part of me as the ocean of love. There's the wave of anxiety. Come on in the ocean of love. Here's the wave of abuse and fear and concern and judgment. Hey, come on in. You're part of the oneness. The wave refuses no ocean. Could we be the ocean and embrace the all parts of ourself with a simple act like the breath? You know, the truth is really simple. It's not always easy to do and follow. The truth is that you're that. What is that? Everything and nothing. Well, that's too vague, David. Yeah, I know, but that's the truth. The truth is so simple. The truth is that you're already there. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing you have to do. It's just be that. Be that. Be what, David? Be that. That you are. Which is the allness of being. Which is the ocean of love. Which is the peace that passes all understanding. Which is the joy of existence. I love that French phrase, joie de vivre, the joy of love itself. And sometimes when people die, you find this strange joy. When you get a wake-up call from the universe, as Norma Jean did, there's this strange joy. It took a car accident to wake me up. Boy, I've never been happier. You have a stroke and you think you're dying and part of your brain's gone and you come back as a different person. My God, I lost a part of me that I didn't really identify with, and there's something that's emerging that's so much greater. Could I see the beauty in that and surrender to that? You know, I love this phrase from the Buddhist. He says, we don't learn from experience, we learn from our capacity to experience. So everything I'm doing at this stage of life is to try to expand that capacity. And in order to do that, I have to have a few screws loose so I'm not so fixed and controlled in my thinking, but so that I can open and ponder the imponderable, that which has no answers. I can enter into the unknown and stay in the beginner's mind. So lastly, I'm going to give you a poem by, I love poetry, and this is by Mark Nepo. And it's how not to abdicate the breath. How not to abdicate your true nature. The place that we call home. The place, hopefully, that you come here to experience and rediscover and remember. I am remembering who I am. Yeah, I'm that. So here's his beautiful poem on how not to abdicate this place that we all long for. Oh, I'm in the wrong book. How can I find abdication in that book when it's in this book? I read so many of these poems only to find just the right one, so I hope this is just the right one. It really speaks to my heart. He says, when decisions are complicated, try to go below them where the job is simply to go on breathing. When things are complicated, go below the problem and just go and start breathing, he says. If in pain, the task is to remove what is paining you now. Huh. If there's a splinter in your finger, take the splinter out. And he says, and then just keep on breathing. He says, if you can't, he says, then the work must go the other way until you soften and enlarge like water around whatever strikes it. So when you can't let go of the pain, maybe you can expand around the pain and begin to love the pain and then have a catharsis like Savannah did. He says, when events seem too important, resist the pull to a yes or a no, and just breathe yet again. When things are so important, you don't have to make a decision of yes or no. I don't want to know what to do. If there's a civil war in the country, am I going to leave? I don't have a clue, yes or no, but I can go into the breath and breathe. He said, if someone presses left or right, take the unmarked way. Huh. And in taking the unmarked way, breathe yet again. He says, and when nothing seems to matter, find the early light and stand like a tree in the wind and breathe with the tree. When you can't find meaning and life doesn't seem to matter, could you just take refuge in the wisdom and the depth of a wise old tree? He says, stay this way long after your arms tire. Stay this way until you are unsure of what matter really means to you, and continue to breathe. I can remember as a young man, I thought everything was so important, everything mattered so much. And there was a lady named Judith Heller in New York City. She says, David, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, David.
No, it does matter. It really matters.
David, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Just wait until you get to that place. It really doesn't matter. And then pretend that you have roots like the tree. And be still yet again. And despite the urge to run away, and things will find that they are alive within you like the tree, and you simply go on breathing. You simply go on breathing like the tree. So let's just go into that awareness that he so beautifully evoked within our hearts. That we don't have to have the answers to life. And that when thoughts are confused or emotions seem turbulent, we can go below them to the breath, to that reassuring part of ourselves, and take refuge in it. And observe how it's always offering itself to us, like this gentle reminder that I am here for you. And so as we invite our bellies to expand and for our chest to rise up, we feel the breath going as deeply as it wants to go. And then we don't cling to it and hold on to it. We can't be attached to it because we have to give it back to life. So we exhale and give it back to life. And we recognize that this is a natural flow that all creation has. The trees breathe. The birds breathe. Even the fish breathe through their gills. I believe this whole planet is alive with spirit, and it's the breath of God. In Hawaii, they call it aloha, the breath of spirit. And they refer to the white man as the howlies, the ones that don't breathe. But we're going to prove them wrong. We're going to let that aloha consciousness breathe us. And the second spiritual tradition they have in Hawaii is ohana. Ohana is the family, the spiritual family. And I'm sitting in a room with my ohana, my sangha. And how important it is to find your ohana and breathe with your ohana. And the third leg of their spiritual tradition is ho'oponopono, which basically says, if there is a distorted thought, I have to thank it and forgive it and polish the mirror of my heart yet again and my mind and see it with a new light, not with a condemning, judgmental, critical eye, but to see it through the eyes of grace. And then we can receive the blessing of everything, even the things that are uncomfortable. So breathing in, we breathe in. And breathing out, we breathe out. In. Out. And as Maharaji said, as we cultivate this still point of awareness, just wait for grace to arise. The unmerited givingness of life itself to its creation, and we are that creation. I invite you to place your hands over the Sacred Heart, the Heart of the One, and join with me in this heart salutation to that sacred space that you have yet remembered and rediscovered within yourself by saying to this space that we all share, I honor you.
I honor you.
I respect you.
I respect you.
I love you.
I love you.
You are the deepest aspect of myself.
You are the deepest aspect of myself.
The beloved within me bows to the beloved within all.
The beloved within me bows to the beloved within all.
In this sacred space, we find oneness.
In this sacred space, we find oneness. Mm.
And so like a good little octopus, open your tentacles, open your eyes, and wiggle your tentacles because you have arrived. You are home in the ocean of love where there is no other. Thanks for your tithes, everyone. Stay safe.
Listening to our podcast. For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org.